You're listening to Vatican Radio. The celebrations marking Holy Week and Easter comprise one of the busiest periods here in the Vatican, with hundreds of thousands of people flocking to Rome to take part in the liturgies, recalling Christ's passion, crucifixion and resurrection. On Easter Sunday morning, the Pope's Mass in St. Peter's Square, followed by his Urbi et Orbi blessing to the Church and to the world, is broadcast live on television and radio stations in countries right across the globe. An important part of all these celebrations is the music, performed principally by the Sistine Chapel Choir in both St. Peter's Basilica and at the Colosseum, where the Pope leads the traditional Via Crucis, or Way of the Cross. Among the voices you can hear during the celebrations this year is that of a young English baritone, Mark Spiropoulos, the first Englishman to be hired as a full-time singer with the Sistine Chapel Choir. He talked to me about his work, about the choir's vision, and about its ecumenical vocation. Mark, you're the first Englishman to sing with the Sistine Chapel Choir. Is that a bit surprising, perhaps, given the significance of the English choral tradition?
Well, first since the Reformation. It's likely that there was one before the Reformation, we don't know. But certainly since the Reformation, we have no records of a British singer. I kind of arrived in the Sistine Chapel by accident. Very fortuitous accident. I came to Italy to investigate the opera houses. I went to Turin and to Venice and Rome, and I had consultations with a maestri there. And while I was in Rome, someone said, why don't you get in touch with Maestro Palombella at the Sistine Chapel Choir? So I sent him an email, and he invited me in for a conversation, and we ended up talking for 2 hours. About the Anglican choral tradition and British music in general. And then he said, opened the door and said, this is the choir, go and join them. They were all sitting there. So we said, go and join the bass section. So I sat there for a 2-hour rehearsal. And then he invited me back for Christmas and then for the consistory last year. And then gave me a 4-month trial contract, which started in March last year. And then I officially started with a proper contract in September.
You grew up and you trained in England, didn't you? How did you first discover your passion for music, for singing?
I was always interested in singing as a kid. And when I was 10 years old, my mother packed me off to do a singing course up in Yorkshire. It was with the then director of music of Eton, and it was a week of kids singing. And really, I had no experience of singing to then. I don't think my mother quite realised that it was a very high-level, intensive choral training that I was being sent up for. And we put together a lot of very intricate choral repertoire, including the Requiem by Mozart. Having had no choral experience up to that point, I was then put into a concert with the altos, tenors and basses from King's College, Cambridge, and a very fine orchestra, I don't know where they're from. And it was a revelation to me. I came back from that week as a completely different boy.
And you were hooked from then on?
Yeah. I've been singing ever since then. I joined the choirs and found out as much as I could about music. It developed a fascination with music, which has stayed with me.
And yet, of course, like many artists, you discovered that it's not easy to earn a living, is it, by being a singer? I know that at one point you were selling flowers outside the opera house.
I wasn't selling the flowers. I was presenting the flowers. But yes, I was. I used to work at the Royal Opera House. I used to be the flower presenter, or the botanical tributes presentations consultant, as I call myself. I was the person who presented the flowers on the stage, so at the end of each performance I'd walk on with a bouquet. But as ridiculous as that job might sound, it was a great education because I saw world-class artists from opera and ballet performing every night, and I would stand on the stage and watch this incredible spectacle every night and then walk on with this bouquet.
So in fact an important part of your experience, your training, your formation,
strangely,
if you want
to
call it that.
Yeah.
The Sistine Chapel Choir has a very mixed history, doesn't it, over the centuries? It's had varying reputations. It's one of the oldest choirs in the world, I believe.
It's, in fact, the oldest choir in the world. It goes back to about the 6th century. The popes always had in their entourage a group of singers. So we are the Cappella Musicale Pontificia, which means we are the Pope's chapel choir. And that means that we aren't based geographically, we're based with the Pope. We are, since the Sistine Chapel was built, we've been based in there, but if the Pope should move to, for example, Avignon, then that's where we would go. And yes, we've been in through various different formations over the years, and we've had high points and low points.
Over recent years, under Maestro Palombella, the current director, of course, it's beginning to get a very good reputation, isn't it? And last September, there was the first ever recording.
That's right.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, last September, we brought out our CD, our first CD, which had been recorded in the Sistine Chapel. In fact, it was the first ever CD to be recorded in the Sistine Chapel. It was on the Deutsche Grammophon label, and we are producing five CDs in total over the 5 years with them. The music is all music from the Sistine Chapel's tradition, including a lot by Palestrina, Orlando di Lasso, and also the Allegri Miserere. The Allegri Miserere is a very particular piece of music which has had various different interpretations over the years. The castrati, which started to come in after about 1600, overlaid the music with incredible ornamentation, and it is known in a particular form which was notated in 1900 after generations of ornamentation. What we recorded on that CD was the earliest texts that we have from the earliest codex of 1613, which is as close as you will get to Allegri's original manuscript, and it's much more like a Renaissance piece of polyphony. There's no soaring top Cs, there's no melismatic ornamentation, but there's a very beautiful Renaissance motet, and that's what we recorded.
The choir is a specialist, isn't it, very much in this Renaissance period?
Yes. The most important heritage of our repertoire comes from the Renaissance period. There was a great age of composition, particularly between 1500 and 1600, the culmination of which is Palestrina. And you can understand Palestrina as being the musical equivalent of Michelangelo. That's not to say we don't sing modern repertoire. We sing Poulenc, and Maestro Palombella is encouraged to write new music for all of our services. But the core of our repertoire is from the Renaissance, and in that sense we have to be specialists in Renaissance singing.
What kind of success has this first album had, first CD had?
Well, I'm happy to say it's been very well received. Deutsche Grammophon have been very happy, and so have we. It was at number one on Amazon, it was on number one on the Italian charts, in the UK charts. It has sold extremely well, perhaps surprisingly well for its repertoire.
You're also very keen, aren't you, to try and interest the younger generations, people who perhaps wouldn't be interested necessarily in classical music, to reach out to new audiences, aren't you?
I think this music has a great power. I think it's very exciting, and I think it's very important as a piece of Western art. I think that we can gain a huge amount from listening to this music and from singing it. I think particularly for myself, when I was a young singer, when I was a child, this music, it's perhaps pretentious to say, but it changed my life. It did change my life. And it stuck with me. So I am very passionate that children should get a chance to sing this music.
You've got the idea in the works to collaborate with a number of schools, including your own school, haven't you?
That's right. My old school. I invited, in fact, my old choir master from Worth School in Sussex in England, who came out for the launch of our CD. And Maestro Palombella then invited him and the Choir of Worth to come over and sing with the Sistine Chapel Choir, which I think will be the first British school choir to sing with the Sistine Choir and to sing for a papal service, which is very exciting. And so I went back to Worth in January to work with the choir. You can see on their faces how excited they were. I mean, it's just fantastic. They really responded, because there's nothing patronising or condescending about this music. It's the real thing. And I think children know when they're given the real thing.
And allows them perhaps to discover a talent and a depth that they didn't know they had.
Absolutely. And it connects them with this incredible art, this incredible world, actually, which is so far from the normal, from the mundane, from the banal. It really opens people's eyes when you experience it. And when you experience it from singing it, your experience, it's like being in a Michelangelo fresco.
Maestro Palombello is particularly interested in the English experience, isn't he? And particularly in the idea of an ecumenical relationship.
Absolutely. Maestro Palombello is fascinated, actually, by the British choral tradition and the Anglican choral repertoire. He's studied a lot of it. He knows it very well. And part of his transformation of the choir, actually, was to look at the Anglican model and to see what they were doing well and what the Sistine Chapel could learn from it. At the same time, Pope Francis is very keen to reach out to lots of groups, particularly Christian groups, and the Anglican Church, and to concentrate on what we have in common.
We had Westminster Abbey Choir over here, didn't we, a couple of years ago, and the Sistine went back and sang for the first time ever, I think, since the Reformation in Westminster Abbey.
That's right. The first collaboration since Palombello took over was with Westminster Abbey. They came and sung with us. That was before I started. But last year, we sang at Westminster Abbey. We went back there. We sang choral evensong, and we gave a concert. It's a fascinating and very useful tool, if I may put it that way, of ecumenical relations. The Vatican can talk a lot about theology. It can talk a lot about friendship and Christian unity. But when two choirs actually sing together, this is practical ecumenism. This is a religious and a cultural exchange, which both sides can engage with fully and learn from. Words are a very important form of expression, but so is art and so is music. It's another language, and it's one which we experience in a different way.
You were brought up in the Anglican or the Catholic tradition?
I was brought up in the Catholic tradition, so I was baptised Roman Catholic, I was raised Roman Catholic, and I went to Worth schools, educated as a Roman Catholic. Since then, most of the singing I've done, choral singing I've done, has been in Anglican churches. I went to Trinity College Dublin, where I was a choral scholar there, and from there I was a choral scholar at St. Patrick's Cathedral Dublin, which is the Church of Ireland Anglican Cathedral. So the office of choral evensong is something I'm very, very familiar with, and something I cherish. So as to whether I'm a Catholic or an Anglican, I'm most comfortable to say both.
In a way, you personally bridge the tradition that the music is also seeking to do.
I think so. I feel fuller as a person to incorporate both traditions into my cultural makeup. I've never been very interested in any kind of religious tribalism. It doesn't interest me. But I think people are better when they learn from each other. And so I've taken the Anglican tradition and the Roman Catholic tradition, and they are both as important to me as each other.